tomorrow.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
John Bunyan's Christian passes through the Valley of the Shadow of Death while his creator languishes in Bedford Jail. That's in our drama hour at 3 o'clock. But now part two of the 2009 biography of the man who wrote The Lord of the Flies, the Nobel and Booker Prize winner William Golding. Today, with the Second World War over, Golding resumes his pre-war career. The reader is Christian Rodzka.
Golding was demobbed from the Navy in August 1945. He had had an eventful war. He joined up in December 1940, and his first posting was on board a cruiser, HMS Galatea, hunting for the German battleship Bismarck. After the Bismarck was sunk, he served on a destroyer, HMS Wolverine, guarding Atlantic convoys. In February 1942, he applied for and got a commission, becoming Sub-Lieutenant Golding. And a year later, he took command of a new and secret naval weapon, a rocket ship. Essentially, rocket ships were floating high explosive. Each was fitted with 1,000 5-inch projectors, firing rockets that carried a 7-pound explosive charge. The idea was to rain death and destruction across a broad swathe of the enemy's front. Golding captained one of these fearsome craft at D-Day, supporting the Allied landing on Gold Beach. 5 months later, he commanded another rocket ship at the Battle of Walcheren. This was an Allied assault on a German island stronghold west of Antwerp. Though successful, it was costly. Of the 27 naval vessels that took part, 20 were sunk or severely damaged, and there were hundreds of casualties, many of them Golding's friends. He wrote of ships blowing up into Christmas trees of exploding ammunition, while the sea filled with broken, drowning men. "These are memories," he said, "that dim the sunlight." After the war, he went back to school teaching at Bishop Wordsworth School, Salisbury, where he taught briefly before joining up. School teaching was not a profession that appealed to him, but he had to live, and by this time he had a wife and two children to support, David, aged 5, and baby Judy. Pupils he taught remembered that his way of conducting lessons was to enter the room, tell them to get on with some task that would keep them quiet, and then walk up and down the aisle between the desks. After the lesson, they would try to calculate how far he'd walked. Sometimes he would have a volume of Greek in his hand. He taught himself Greek in the Navy. Sometimes he would laugh or talk to himself. A variant was for him to sit at the front of the class writing in a school exercise book, tucked out of sight below the master's desk. What he was writing was fiction. He had decided to become a novelist. His colleagues mocked his ambition, remarking that he could not even spell, which was true to some extent. But he persevered and finished 3 books. The first was an account of their family holiday in 1947, when he bought an old lifeboat and took his wife Anne and the children sailing along the south coast. The other 2 books were novels. All 3 remain in typescript. He sent them to every publisher he could think of, and they were all rejected. Then, one winter evening in 1951, he and Anne were sitting by the fire, having got the children to bed, and he found himself thinking about the book he'd been reading to them, R.M. Ballantyne's Coral Island. "Wouldn't it be a good idea," he said, "if I wrote a book about children on an island, children who behave in the way children really would behave?" Anne was enthusiastic and told him to get on with it. By the end of 1952, it was finished, and during the next few months he posted his increasingly battered typescript to 6 publishers and a literary agent, all of whom posted it back. Then, in September 1953, he sent it to Faber and Faber. The professional reader Faber's employed to assess new works of fiction was called Polly Perkins, and having read, or at any rate looked at Golding's typescript, she recorded her verdict in green biro on the top left-hand corner of his submission letter. "Absurd and uninteresting fantasy about the explosion of an atom bomb on the colonies," Polly Perkins wrote. "A group of children who land in jungle country near New Guinea. Rubbish and dull. Pointless. Reject." And that would have been that if Charles Monteith had not intervened. Monteith was to become one of the legendary publishers of the 20th century, who signed up for Faber and Faber a dazzling array of writers, among them Samuel Beckett, Philip Larkin, Tom Stoppard, Ted Hughes and Seamus Heaney. But in 1953, he was a new boy. The son of a Belfast draper, Monteith had won a scholarship to Oxford and got a first in English. During the war, he served with the Royal Inniskilling Fusiliers in India and Burma, and then went back to Oxford and got a first in law. He planned to be a barrister, but decided he did not have the necessary killer instinct, so became a publisher instead, joining Faber and Faber less than a month before Golding's dog-eared typescript, with Polly Perkins's damning annotation, landed on his desk. Monteith took it home, read it, and was gripped. Having been a fat, bespectacled schoolboy himself, he squirmed for fat, bespectacled Piggy, whom the other boys ridicule and eventually kill. But the book had, he decided, serious flaws. The most difficult one to put right was the boy called Simon, who, in the original version of the novel that Monteith read, and that survives in Golding's manuscript, is very evidently a Christ figure. In the manuscript, Simon has an intuition, rather like Adam in the Garden of Eden, that there is a prohibition against eating the fruit on the island. Further, when he is alone in the forest, he meets the being who has issued the prohibition. This being is clearly meant to be God. Human eyes cannot look upon him. So we are told he was merciful and veiled Simon's eyes and dulled the feelings of his body. Simon, the manuscript goes on, is filled with wild delight. He begins to dance, and butterflies dance round his head, and the mysterious being joins in the dance with him. Simon wants to bring the other boys to meet this being and be healed, happy, and without fear. So he runs back, filled with knowledge and mystery, to where the smaller boys are and begins to dance. They laugh at first, but then dance too, because, Golding writes, they knew in their blood how important these strange gestures and the stately weaving were. But at this point, the bigger boys come back and spoil it all. Monteith decided that all this supernatural stuff must go. The mysterious being and the mystical dances and everything else that makes Simon more than just a schoolboy must be cut. He told Faber's book committee that he would like to discuss revision with the author. No one else thought it was worthwhile, but they decided to let him have a try. In a series of letters over the next few months, Monteith persuaded Golding to accept every single one of the changes he wanted. At first, he met some resistance. "I suppose you agree," Golding wrote, "that I must convey a theophany of some sort." But a theophany, which means the appearance of a god, was just what Monteith did not want. He was determined that Simon should be, as he put it, explicable in purely rational terms. And gradually, he deleted every vestige of the mysterious being and of Simon's supernatural experience from the typescript. Golding willingly cooperated in the changes. "If you want to throw away any more of Simon," he wrote, "go ahead." At the same time, it made him ill. He had developed a high temperature, he told Monteith, and could hardly bear to look at the novel any more. It seems likely that he felt so deeply because agreeing to cut God out of the novel meant concealing or betraying his Christian belief. He wrote elsewhere that the horrors he witnessed in the war had brought about a sort of religious convulsion, and the boys he taught at Bishop Wordsworth's school got the impression he was a devout Christian. He would fire questions at them like, "How many of you say your prayers at night?" Those who said they didn't would be asked why not. Once, he drew a chalk line round the classroom wall with a cross near the door and another cross near the end of the line. The line, he explained, represented the spiritual life. The first cross was the moment of conversion when you acknowledge your faith in Jesus Christ. The second cross was the moment of illumination, which most people never reach. Simon, as Golding first wrote the novel, could be seen as a boy who reaches the moment of illumination. At last, in February 1954, Monteith persuaded Faber and Faber's book committee to accept the novel in its new form. They offered Golding an advance of £60. In fact, Monteith had suggested 50, but the chairman put it up to 60 in view of the author's patience over the revisions. Golding declared himself delighted with these terms. The title remained a problem. Golding had given the book a rather puzzling title, Strangers from Within. No one at Faber's liked this, so he came up with an alternative, A Cry of Children, which they didn't like either. It was an editor at Faber's, Alan Pringle, who hit on the title Lord of the Flies, which Golding immediately accepted. In the months before publication, Monteith tried to whip up some advance publicity without success. The committee of the Cheltenham Book Festival did not even shortlist it for their first novel award. It looked as if the Book Society might give it some space in their monthly magazine, but in July Monteith broke the news to Golding that they were not going to accord it an official recommendation after all. Golding replied that their recommendations were often no good, and maybe Faber should overprint the cover, not recommended by the Book Society. He apologised for his frivolity, adding, I've just been sailing and am still feeling rather bluff and seamanlike. It was a revealing addition. In the next few years, sailing was to become deeply important to him. It was where he found freedom and happiness and escaped the fears and anxieties of writing. But all this lay in the future, as he and Monteith awaited the publication of Lord of the Flies on the 17th of September, 1954. On publication day, a zinc bath packed with ice and bottles of champagne appeared in the staff room at Bishop Wordsworth School, and there were convivial scenes. One master, a fitness fanatic, stood on his head on the heap of ice that remained in the bath when the rejoicing was over. The novel got its first review that same day, Pat Murphy in the Daily Mail finding it most compelling. I fell under the terrible spell of this book, and so will many others, Murphy prophesied. Next day was even better. The Evening News found it enthralling. The Times praised its vivid realism. Time and Tide hailed it as a work of universal significance. On the 19th, in The Observer, the poet Stevie Smith acclaimed this beautiful and desperate book as quite out of the ordinary. By this time, one imagines, Polly Perkins and the directors of several publishing firms were beginning to feel rather poorly. Lord of the Flies was to sell 20 million copies in Britain alone and be translated into more than 30 languages. But despite the critical acclaim, it was not a runaway success at first. By the end of 1954, it had sold 4,500 copies, a decent showing but by no means a bestseller. Monteith's faith in Golding's powers never wavered, however. Months before publication, and months before any critic had pronounced on it, he was already asking Golding for a second novel.
William Golding, the man who wrote Lord of the Flies, was written and abridged for radio by John Carey. The reader was Christian Rodsker. And tomorrow we'll find out how Golding's career and reputation take off when he's invited to work the American lecture circuit.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Hello, 3 o'clock now. This is Joanna Pinnock. In a moment, The Pilgrim's Progress continues. Neil Dudgeon stars in John Bunyan's story about one man's struggle to stay out of danger and on the right path to the celestial city. Then it's hiking boots on for today's very outdoorsy 4 o'clock show as Mel discovers the art to making the perfect fire and fishes for some stripy, spiky perch. All that and Swallows and Amazons too in an hour. So now on with The Pilgrim's Progress. Published in the late 17th century, Bunyan began writing his Christian allegory while in Bedford Prison, locked away for his non-conformist preaching. His statue now stands right in the heart of town, right by some traffic lights on a busy road junction, as I remember. In part two of our dramatisation by Brian Sibley, as the writer's fate hangs in the balance, Christian continues his hazardous journey, passing through the Valley of the Shadow of Death.
John Bunyan, tinker of the town of Bedford. You were on the 12th day of the month of November, in the year 1660, apprehended and taken into custody for preaching at an unlawful religious assembly, to the great disturbance and destruction of the good subjects of this kingdom, contrary to the laws of our sovereign lord the king. You will be sent to prison, and there remain until you will promise and swear that in future you will abandon all such illegal practices. Take him away.